And today's going to be worse. because these things just have to be gotten out of the way. You have to know that there are answers to these questions. Otherwise, somebody later is going to say, hey, what about that? You're like, oh boy, where do they sell cheeseburgers? You know, it's all down the drain. So at least if you will have heard answers, you'll know there are answers. You don't remember them, you understand them. It won't upset you. And those who do understand, not those, very good. I'm going to wait another 2 minutes because I started 10 after the hour. It's one of the protests. Okay, I'm going to talk about certain problems with free will, scientific, philosophical. The first one I'd like you to understand. The second two, maybe if you know that they exist and that there are ways to handle them, will be enough. But the first one's important for itself, and the methodology is important for other problems as well. Now, I'm going to do it twice. First time round will be very simple, but very unrealistic. Second time round, I'll make it realistic, but you'll see that the same logic that knocked it off when it was simple will knock it off when it's realistic. Suppose someone says, there is no such thing as free will. Because everything you do is caused by forces outside of you. We said yesterday, if something pushes you down the stairs, you're not responsible. It's not your free will. Well, everything you do, you're being pushed down the stairs. Everything. Why? Because the world around you, your environment, forces you to do what you do. You're a child, and your parents train you. And you live in a certain culture, and the culture influences you, teaches you, trains you. And at any moment in life, you're surrounded by an environment, and the environment is influencing you. Certain stimuli are hitting you from the environment. So your childhood and your culture train you to react in certain ways. And then, under a certain circumstance, you get a stimulus from the environment and you react the way you were trained to react. You are just a creature of your environment. Forces from outside you trained you, taught you, programmed you. And now the present stimulus calls forth a response. Just like you have a program in your computer. So you bought the program from someplace and stuck it in. Now when you press a key, you get a response. You are a programmed computer. The environment programmed you, and at the moment there's a stimulus, and then you respond. You're no more responsible for what you do than your computer is responsible for what it does. You have no more free will than your computer does. That's what they say. Now, we should ask, why do you say that? You have any reason for saying that? Any proof that it's true? You say there's no free will, okay? But you can't just say something like that. You have to have a reason. So here's the reason. If you look at people from different environments, you'll see that they develop in different ways. Take an urban slum. Watts, Los Angeles. Harlem, New York. 80% grow up functionally illiterate. Take Shaker Heights, Ohio, or Beverly Hills, 100% go up functionally literate. So you see, the environment makes an enormous difference. And this is regular, repeats year after year, generation after generation. In Watts, by the time they're 18, 90% have experimented with hard drugs. And in Shaker Heights, 100% of experimented. I mean, oh, okay, all right. 10% have expended the benefit of hard drugs. 75% of the Watts have a criminal record, and in Shaker Heights, they're rich enough to prevent them from a criminal record. You know, there are differences. Different environments produce different results in human development. That's why we say that the environment programs you and produces everything you do. So we should ask. But your study of the environment, your study of the environment produces numbers in percentages, 70%, 75%, 80%. You didn't give me any 100%. 80% can't read, but 20% can. 90% have tried drugs, but 2% have not. 75% have criminal records, but 25% do not. Why do you say that is the environment alone that's doing the job? The environment's doing the whole job. The environment completely programs you and completely causes everything you do if your statistics are all less than 100%. If the environment alone is doing the job all by itself, then you ought to give me 100% statistics. It's like saying that such and such is a deadly poison. And when you give it to people, 70% die and 30% don't. Then there must be something else other than the poison that's going on. Can't be that it all by itself kills people. Now, they have an answer for this. And what's crucial is to understand that the answer is totally incompetent. The answer goes like this. True, the statistics we have provided are less than 100%. You're right. But the differences between the 80% who don't read and the 20% who do read is also due to the environment. It's not something different. It's not something else. It's also due to the environment. But it's due to smaller factors, details of the environment. Yes, they're all growing up in Watts. But this one had an uncle who took a special interest in the child and played the role of a surrogate father, and he was there every night to help the child read. Or that one was in a class with an older sibling because of aging problems, and the older sibling helped keep the child stable. There are always factors in the environment that determine the difference between the 20% who do learn how to read and the 80% who do not. So really, they will tell you, it's always the environment. It's still the environment. What's wrong with that answer? What's wrong with it is that they're only guessing. They're only guessing. They claim that there are other factors in the environment, but they don't produce them. They don't define them. They don't investigate them. Because if they did, then they would be able to provide 100% statistics. If you come from Watts, and you don't have an uncle who helps you out, and you don't have an older sibling in your class, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then 100% of the time you don't learn to read. But they don't do that. All they say is this. It's still the environment because there must be. Always be suspicious when somebody says there must be. There must be means, I really don't know, I'm just guessing. There must be, somewhere in the environment, other factors that make the difference. At this point, we should get off the boat. What we should say is, if there are, produce them. After all, you're a scientist. And as a scientist, I expect you to produce evidence. Not just to tell me what you fervently believe in your heart. I can do that too without any evidence. You claim the environment does it all by itself. All by itself with no help from any other factor. When I point out that your statistics are less than 100%, which leaves open the possibility some other factor is operating here, you say, no, no, it's not any other factor. It's other details in the environment, but you don't tell me what they are. You don't define them. You don't do an experiment to see whether those factors in the environment really make the difference. So you're guessing. I don't have to roll over and play dead because you're guessing. I'll pay attention to your evidence if you present me with real positive evidence. But if you just say it's the environment, I don't have to believe that. This is very important because in defending theories, when people run into trouble, they often defend the theory by saying, well, there's some other factor, the same as what my theory says, and that's what's doing the job, but they don't present it to you. They don't show it to you. And they don't show it to you, so then they're just guessing. And if they're guessing, you don't have to accept what they say. Now, I said this was unrealistic. Why is it unrealistic? By the way, did anybody catch that? Why is this an unrealistic picture of what makes you do what you do? that the environment programs you and causes you to do things. Haven't I left out, from their point of view, the cash, the one people are raising the critique, haven't I left out something very important? No. From those who claim that we are robots, I had them saying we're robots because of the environment. No one would make a claim like that, just because of the environment. Are we not leaving out something very important? A person who says you're a robot, is he going to say you're a robot because of the environment alone? The environment alone determines everything you do? That would be extraordinarily dumb, even for them.
Wasn't until you were programmed.
Well, they say the environment is programming you. That's what I'm questioning. Will they say that the environment alone programs you and that determines everything you do? No. What am I leaving out? No, from their point of view, they say that we're a robot. I'm trying to explain their critique. Right? No one is going to come and say you're a robot because of the environment programs you all by itself totally. If they say you're a robot, they're going to add something that I've left out.
Initial fact, initial settings.
Which is, in biological terms? DNA. I left out DNA. If you send a mouse to school, will it learn to read? Same environment. Bring it up in your house. Feed it with care and concern. Never leave it alone. Treat it with kindness. Will it learn to read? It's a mouse. No one is going to say that the environment alone makes you what you are. The DNA also plays a role. No, what they'll tell you is it's the environment plus the DNA, of course, the two of them working together. And that's what determines. The DNA gives you your initial features and also helps build later features as you go along, and the environment interacts with the DNA, and the two together completely program you, make you into a robot, completely cause everything you do, and both are forces from outside of you. Right? The DNA comes from your parents, the environment is around you. But now, if I use the same technique over again, you'll see that this is even worse. This is even worse than the first position. What question should we ask when they tell us that the environment and the DNA program what you do? What's the question we should ask? What question did I start with the first time around? You guys. Let's serve coffee here. Evidence. What evidence do you have for it? What reason do you have for it? A person can't just say something. He has to have a reason. He has to have evidence. You say that the DNA plus the environment completely, totally cause what I do. They determine, they make me into a robot. So I ask, what evidence do you have for that? Now what he ought to do is produce some kind of evidence. What would the evidence look like? Well, people with these and these genes and with that and that environment always do thus and thus. So I could see how the genes and the environment together work to produce my behavior. But this they can't do at all, because they can't specify the genes that are supposed to be responsible for behavior. They don't know how to do that. See, they can't give you any evidence. With the environment, they can give you statistics that are incomplete. Here, they can't give you any evidence, because they can't isolate. Yes, they have a mapping of the genome, but they can't tell you what each piece of genome does. That will take a long time before they figure that out. Especially because of pleiotropism. Each gene does 10 different things, and each thing is done by 20 different genes working together. It's very complicated. So if I ask, what reason do you have to think that the genes plus the environment totally cause, totally force, totally determine everything you do? What evidence do you have? Show me. Specify genes, specify the environment, and predict what will happen. That's the way you test theories. The answer is they cannot do that at all. They can't begin to do that. So why do they believe it? If you talk to scientists, they will tell you this, you know, and if you disagree with them, they look at you and say, land it for the moon. Why do they believe such a thing? Here's the reason. Because they start with an assumption that there is only the physical world. That's their assumption. We are physical creatures living in a physical world. Period. So therefore, only physical things can have an effect. Nothing else can have an effect. Well, let's take a look around. What physical things do we know have an effect? Well, we know the DNA has an effect. And we know that the physical environment has an effect. And that's all we've ever been able to tell that has an effect. So, the logical thing to do is to say that the DNA and the physical environment do the whole job, because those are the two physical factors that we know have an effect. But of course, that's all based on the assumption that there's nothing more than the physical. That's just an assumption. Science is based on that assumption, according to many. Okay, very good. Doesn't mean it's true. It just means they've assumed it. So there is no reason to accept it when they tell you that it must be so. Are you with me so far? You understand me? Oh, good.
These people who claim that today, do any of them actually believe to the extent that they were one that lived in such a way that responsibility? Has anyone ever put this forward?
Okay, so I didn't talk about this, but there is a widespread philosophical position that even if what you do is because of a push from outside of you, this kind of push, DNA plus environment, you're still responsible. That's the way they get out of it. You're right, they have to face this problem. They don't want to say nobody's responsible for what he does. So they try to hold that you're still responsible. There is such a position, and it's mistaken for certain reasons. I wasn't going to do it. If people here want to hear that, I'll do that instead of something else. But you're more likely to meet scientists than philosophers, so you're more likely to run into the other sort of problem. But that's what they will say. They'll say irresponsible anyway. Even against, you know, what I said yesterday and earlier, they'll say you are responsible.
Does it be like making a lion responsible for killing a zebra?
Okay. Not the way they define it, but they're aware of that problem. And anyway, I'd rather not do it now because there are other things that I want to handle. Another line you'll meet from scientists is this: your washing machine doesn't have free will, right? Right. Your computer doesn't have free will, right? Right. Yours does. Yeah, right. He's eating the socks, right? That's where the socks go. They disappear whenever. My solution was to get 24 pair of identical socks. That's it. You know, well, now it's about 19 now. But, you know, at least a pair. Stay paired. A frog doesn't have free will. No. Why? Because from our point of view, they're all machines. Some machines are made out of tin. Some machines are made out of electric wire or magnetic coils. Some machines are made out of flesh, but they're all machines. Well, they'll tell you, well, your brain is just a meat machine. It's made out of meat and it's a machine. Like the frog, like the computer, like the washing machine. It's just material stuff, physical stuff, and it operates under physical principles. It's a machine. If you don't think that your washing machine or your computer or a frog have free will, there's no reason to think your brain has free will, because your brain is just a meat machine. That's all it is. People called cognitive scientists, maybe that's an oxymoron, will tell you this for sure. The brain is a meat machine, and therefore free will is just a fantasy. It's just impossible. Now, I'll just tell you two very brief things about this. There's a fellow at Oxford named Roger Penrose. Roger Penrose won the Nobel Prize in Physics, so I guess he isn't dumb. He and Stephen Hawking worked together on black holes in the 70s. And he has created a whole industry. He claims he has a proof that the brain cannot be any kind of machine that we today recognize. The brain cannot be any kind of machine that we today recognize. This is a proof based on mathematical reasoning. It can't be. Now, he has stirred up a tremendous storm of controversy, as you could imagine. But everybody agrees he isn't dumb. And that being the case, if somebody tells you, we know the brain is just a meat machine, you should ask him, who's we? Does it include Roger Penrose? So then you left somebody out. Maybe they should say some of we know. But the rest of we don't know. Or know something opposite. Indeed, Penrose says there's something wrong with our science. Our scientific theories are fundamentally wrong because they don't apply to the brain. He wants to say that the brain is a machine, but of a new type that's unrecognized. None of our scientific theories describe it correctly. And we have to change science in order to describe this new type of machine. And he even has some suggestions where quantum mechanics should be changed in order to try to accommodate it, though he hasn't been able to carry it through in detail yet. So that's one negative, if somebody claims that the brain's a machine. The other negative is this. How many of you here have heard of chaos theory? This is really very unfortunate. The word chaos makes it sound like something's out of control. Something just sort of happening for no reason. That's not the truth. Chaos systems are completely determined mechanical systems. Completely determined. 100% mechanical. You can simulate them on the computer, and you can predict what they will do. If you define the system on the computer, you can predict what it will do forever with exact precision. So why would anybody use the word chaos? If they really are completely mechanical, and they really can be predicted, when you define them on the computer, you can predict everything they'll do, why would anybody call them chaos? Here's the reason. Because in real life, if you have a physical system, and it's a chaos system, you cannot predict what it will do. Even though it's a completely mechanical system, you cannot predict what it will do. I'll give you a very simple example. A pool table. A snooker table? Does that speak to some of you? You know? Yeah, there we are. Brought some people into the discussion. Billiards, for the very polite among you. Now, what do you have here? You have a table, and it has pockets. And there are balls on various places on the table, and one of them is white. That's the signal. That's the one you hit with the stick, right? The end of the stick, the pointed end. Not sides, not, it's not baseball. Okay. And then that ball rolls, and it hits other balls, and the balls bounce off the sides of the table, and they bounce into each other, and some of them go into the pockets. It's completely mechanical. There are no genies here, no pixies, no leprechauns banging the balls as they go by. Right? It's just a billiards table. That's all it is. Now, let's suppose we know where the balls are. Here's the white ball. Here's the cue stick. And it's going to hit the white ball. It hits the white ball at some angle or other. Right? If it hits it at this angle, the ball goes off. Hits that ball, which goes into the pocket, it bounces off over to here, knocks that ball over to the side, that ball ricochets off the side, goes that way and this way, and the balls end up in a different position. Right? Suppose I change the cue stick a little bit. Just a little bit. Change the angle of the cue stick. Instead of hitting it like this, hit it like this. Okay? Now, even if I change the stick a little bit when I hit the ball, as the ball rolls, you know what happens with an angle. An angle looks like this. So that here the difference is very small, but over here the difference is very big. So if you hit the ball at a slightly different angle, 2 feet away, it's going to be considerably distant from where it would have been. So let's say if I hit the cue ball this way, it hits this ball, correct on. If I change it, the stick a little bit, when I hit the cue ball, it hits it on the side. Instead of going straight, this ball goes this way. Then the balls on the table are going to end up in very different positions. A very small change in the cue stick makes a big difference to where the balls end up. Right? Now, that's the definition of a chaos system. A chaos system is one in which a very small change in the input when you start it leads to a very big change in the output, as big as the system will allow. So what? Well, let's suppose we have the billiards table here, the real billiards table. And now I have a computer, and I'm trying to simulate on the computer what the billiards table will do. So I got all the balls, I programmed the computer, and I put the balls in exactly the right spots. I have the cue stick, so I put the cue stick on the screen. Then I measure the angle. I measure the angle that the cue stick is going to hit the ball. And I put that angle onto the screen. How well can we measure? How exact are our measurements? Are our measurements perfect? Our measurements are never perfect. They're never perfect. They're always approximate. For the mathematicians, that's because real numbers are infinite non-repeating decimals, and therefore you could never feed that into any computer, and your measurements are going to be real numbers. So every measurement is approximate. So it means the real table with the real balls and the real cue stick is going in at a certain angle. And on your computer screen, you're feeding in not exactly the same angle. Not exactly the same. A little bit off. But now, what's the definition of a chaos system? A chaos system is one in which a slight difference in input leads to as big a difference in output as the system will allow. So when you run your simulation on the computer and the real table works in the real world, they're not going to match. You can't predict what a chaos system is going to do. A chaos system is perfectly mechanical, but you can't predict what it's going to do. That's why they say there cannot be, in principle, long-range weather forecasting. Because the weather is a chaos system. It's something that was called the butterfly effect. If a butterfly beats its wings in Tokyo, 6 months later, that could be the reason why there's a hurricane off Florida. You see, it's such a small thing, a butterfly beating its wings, but that's what a chaos system is. A chaos system amplifies. It amplifies small differences into big differences. Well, suppose I'm looking at a system from the outside. I don't know what kind of system it is. And I try to predict what it will do, and I fail. I fail repeatedly. Why am I failing? There really are two possibilities. One possibility is that there's something in there that's not predictable. There's a leprechaun in there, and he's fouling up my predictions. Or it's possible that it's really a machine, but it's a chaos system. And chaos systems can't be predicted even though they're mechanical. Suppose I'm standing outside. It's a black box. I'm trying to predict what it will do, and I fail over and over and over again. So I don't know. I don't know what it is. How could you prove it's mechanical? You could only prove it's mechanical if you can predict what it does, more or less. I'm leaving out its subtlety now, but for our purposes today, it'll be enough. If I can repeatedly fail to predict what it does, then there are always those two possibilities. Now, we have a guarantee that you're not going to predict what the brain does. Because if it's a system at all, it's a chaos system. If it's mechanical at all, it's a chaos system. So we know at the outset you're not going to succeed in predicting what the brain does. Just like you can't predict what the weather will do. If I'm standing outside, if I take seriously the question whether or not there's a soul, I don't read it out because I'm too embarrassed to think about it or too afraid to think about it, but I use it as a serious possibility, then I recognize that I'm always going to be confronted by these two possibilities. Either it's a meat machine, which is a chaos system, and that's why I can't predict, or there's a soul interacting with the brain, and that's why I can't predict. I'm always going to be confronted by these two possibilities. So no one can tell you, we know that the brain is a machine, and therefore there can't be any free will. Because no one is going to predict what the brain does. Yeah.
How accurate, by your definition, does a prediction have to be? Because for some people, if there's only so much error, percentage error, then it's negligible. They say you can know enough about the human mind, whether it's psychology, the DSM 4 or 5 or whatever it is, or behavior. So, like, at what point are you holding predictability to be 100%, or does it have to be 99%? Like, how are you defining predictability?
The truth is that if you'll take a gap of, let's say, an hour, your ability to predict will be zero. Try to predict what a person will do an hour from now. And your ability to predict reliably will be zero. It doesn't matter. It's not 99%, it's 98%. Right? Try to predict what you're doing a week from now. Well, what I'll do this evening at 7 o'clock. Even the simplest predictions are just not going to work. Predict what I'll have for supper. Predict what I'll have for breakfast tomorrow morning. Try. And anybody who makes decisions, if a person inculcates a habit, it's true, he could predict, but then he's not making decisions. I'm talking about what he will decide. We're talking about free will, right? When a person makes a decision, it'd be almost impossible to get any predictions at all. Try to predict, this is one famous example, try to predict what sentence the person will next speak.
If you're right, you can be pretty close.
Try it with sentences. Try it with sentences. I mean, there's a functional infinity of sentences, and it's just limited by length. There's a variety, and, the person's vocabulary in English, there are something like 50,000 words in English. So you have 10,000 word vocabulary, and you're going to put together a string of 10 or 12 words. The number, the variety is extraordinary. So it's not even close. It's not even close. It doesn't begin to look like a mechanical system. But I'll tell you, to answer the question more directly, to really have good evidence that something's mechanical, you should be able to explain your failures of prediction. For example, you say, well, there's a certain amount of friction, and we haven't been able to measure the friction, and we know that friction will make a difference in 10 to 20% of the cases, and the variation will be within the certain extremes, so you should predict that before it happens. You should say, it's a kind of system where I'll get 80% right, and the other 20% will be within a 3% tolerance. And then, if you predict that beforehand, and it works out that way, and you can explain where the tolerance comes from, you'll have good evidence. You should be able to tell us yourself how good your predictions will be on the basis of what you think the thing is.
But what about people like Newton who can make very accurate predictions, but the way they compensate their mistakes are actually incorrect? I'm not expressing this very well. But people can compensate their error, but what they're attributing it to might not be what is really causing the error.
I don't know exactly what that means, but the spectacular success that Newton had was that there were certain problems with the planet Neptune, with its orbit, and they calculated that the disturbing feature must be another planet, and they calculated its approximate size, and where it should be, and they said, look there and you'll find it, and they found it. That's pretty spectacular. And with the whole sky to look in, and they said, look there, that means the planets work, according to the Newtonian system, to a very high degree of accuracy. That's spectacular. Now, a person will do that once with a human being, I'll be very happy. Predict for me who will be in the Likud list 2 weeks from now. I'd like to hear that. Yeah.
You're talking about predictability 100% right, being right or wrong. What about probability, though?
Well, that's what he just asked. Huh? Isn't that what he just asked?
How are you defining predictability? I said putting probability or not.
It can include probability, but to be done right, you have to say, I'll get it right 80% of the time, and the 20% I'm going to miss is because of XYZ, and you can see that XYZ will work 20% of the time, and it'll work within certain tolerances. That's the way you would do it. Right? Anyway, so don't let anybody knock you over by telling you that the brain is a machine, and that therefore there can't be any free will. Nobody knows any such thing. Okay, finally, there is a problem that I don't think, I don't know if anyone has a solution to it, not in secular philosophy and not perhaps in Torah thought. I'll describe it to you briefly, and then I'll tell you, how do you live with a problem for which you don't have a solution? I'm talking about how you live it intellectually. And I think that's really the basis on which then that has to be based, but that's another story. What have we said so far? To be free means that there shouldn't be a force outside of me that forces me to do what I do, causes me to do what I do. I have to make the decision. If something outside of me pushes me, pulls me, and forces me to do it, then I'm not doing it. It's not my decision, it's not my free will, and I'm not responsible. Now, the Stoics, 1800 years ago, asked for a little more detail. You've told us what free will isn't. How about telling us a little more about what free will is? In particular, they said, your picture seems to be that you as a human being have certain motivations. You have certain desires, hopes, fears, scruples. Certain things that push you in different directions naturally. But in addition to your hopes and your fears and your desires, your scruples, you have something else called free will. And at least sometimes, free will casts the deciding vote and pushes you one way or the other. And when free will does that, you say you're free and you're responsible. Well, the Stoics asked, how does this free will operate? In particular, we'll give you two choices, they said. Does it operate according to rules or does it not? Those two seem to be the only possibilities, right? Either it does operate according to rules or it does not operate according to rules. Now, they said, whichever one you pick, you're in trouble. And this is the challenge. We have you impaled on the horns of a dilemma. What in yeshivas is called the manashach argument. Let's say you tell me that the free will operates according to rules. So, here I am making a decision. My desires push me this way, and my fears push me that way, and my scruples push me that way. And then my free will comes online. My free will says, okay, what should we do? Let's look at the rules. The rules say, give every fear a score of 6. Mark the sixes. Give every desire a score of 3. 3. Give every scruple a score of 10. Add up. Divide by 62. Multiply the number of hairs on your head. Okay? If it's an even number, do A. So, the free will follows the rules. Comes out. Yes. 4,297,564. Even number. Do A. That's how free will works. It has rules. And it just works by consulting the rules. No. If so, said the Stoics, we should ask, where did the rules come from? How come free will operates according to these rules? Where did these rules come from? Did God program those rules into the will, into the soul someplace? No. If God programmed the rules into the soul, then it's God standing outside, who's another force, another power, who's causing you to do what you do. The soul now is a piece of mechanics like every other piece of mechanics. Or it's your parents who programmed the rules, or it's your society that programmed the rules, or they're stuck in the DNA someplace. So if, the Stoics said, if free will operates according to rules, then you'll have to trace the rules to their source. And when you trace the rules to their source, you'll find out that you're being pushed around by external forces. And you, said Stokes, you told me when there are external forces, you're not responsible. So that's not going to work. Okay, said Stokes, we'll give you the other alternative. The free will operates according to no rules. No rules. No rules. So here I am making the decision. My desires push me one way, and my fears push me another way, and my scruples push me another way. Now free will comes online. What does it do? What do the people do when it comes online? Well, it just sort of, bang, you know, it just goes A. Why does it go A? For no reason, really. It just sort of pops off that way. Just falls over. Because it doesn't operate according to rules. It hasn't got any rules. It's just totally random. Totally random. Totally accidental. I know these words are different. I'm just trying to get an idea across. That's for the tape. If somebody's trained to listen to the tape, I know there are differences. It's accidental. It's random. It's purposeless. It's pointless. It just happens for no reason. Could that be why you are responsible for your actions? Because you have in you an element that pops off for no reason whatsoever and pushes you one way or another? True! It's not pushed by an external force. Okay, I give you that. It's internal, but it's internal random. The fact that you have something inside you that's totally random, that from time to time pushes you in different directions, that makes you responsible for what you do? We don't see, said the Stoics, we don't see any connection between this kind of element, random free will, and responsibility. So the Stoics' challenge is this. If you say free will operates according to rules, you're not responsible. And if you say free will does not operate according to rules, you're not responsible. And the bottom line conclusion will be, you're not responsible. Right? Because you're not responsible if A, you're not responsible if not A, and those are the only two choices, then you're not responsible. Now this challenge has been kicking around for 1800 years. That's not a short time. And no one has found a solution. That problem is as alive today as it was 1800 years ago. Okay, there's a small group of people who's led by a philosopher at Illinois named Timothy O'Connor who think that they do have a solution. But nobody else believes them. So, you know, I'm inclined to be sympathetic, but I wouldn't stake my answer on something that 2% of the philosophical community accepts and 98% does not. So what to do? There are two things to do here. Number one, this isn't the first time that human thought has faced a problem of having an outrageous conclusion following from what looks like a perfectly good argument. This has happened a number of times in the history of thought. They're called paradoxes. Paradox is when you have what looks like a perfectly good argument to a totally outrageous conclusion. What do you do under those circumstances? Let me familiarize you with one quickly. Anybody here ever heard of Zeno? Zeno was a philosopher who lived before Socrates, so he's called pre-Socratic. Huh? Isn't that clever? And he had three arguments that nothing moves. Three arguments that nothing moves. Here's one of his arguments. You think of an arrow moving from A to B over a certain period of time. Now, take any instant in that period of time, right here on the graph. Where is the arrow at this instant? Here. The arrow at this instant is in a particular place. It's in a particular place. It's in one place at that one instant. Of course, if it's in one place at that one instant, it's not moving at that one instant. Another instant over here. Say the arrow's over here. At this instant, it's over here in this one particular place. So at that instant, it's not moving. It's not moving at this instant either. It's not moving at this instant either. Indeed, all the way throughout the whole interval, at every instant, it's not moving. So when is it moving? How can it be moving? Yeah, if at every instant in the interval, it's not moving, so then... Now, I know, you all think that you have answers, but I'm telling you that for 2,300 years, the philosophical and mathematical world struggled with this, and until they invented the mathematics of continuity in the mid-19th century, by Dedekind and Weierstrass, everyone agreed there was no solution. Some people think there still is no solution. That's controversial. If you like Dedekind and Weierstrass, and you like series limits, you can do it if you like that sort of thing. But for 2,300 years, there was no solution. What did people do in the meantime? What did they do in the meantime without a solution for 2,300 years? Did they say, gosh, philosophers are very useful, you know? Look at that, they've discovered that nothing moves. It's worth knowing, huh? It's pretty important that nothing really moves. All motion is an illusion. Nobody said that. Even though they had an argument without any solution, they didn't say that. Why? Because they said that's just too outrageous. That's just too outrageous. You cannot prove to me that nothing moves. There's got to be something wrong with the argument.
even though for 2,000 years we haven't found anything wrong with the argument, there still has to be something wrong with the argument, because the conclusion is too outrageous. In logic, whenever you have an argument sets up a struggle between the premises and the conclusion. And it's not obvious that the premises have to win. Sometimes the conclusion wins, and you say, I can't accept the premises, I can't accept the argument. Now, in this little argument, what are we dealing with? Space, time, motion. That's all. Okay, they're not exactly simple, but they are everyday realities. Realities we deal with confidently. We have measurement procedures for it, and we have a lot of technology based on it. And still, with these relatively common everyday concepts, Zeno was able to tie us up in a knot. What are we facing? We're facing the problem of free will, where we're dealing with the concept of responsibility, and the concept of causation, and the concept of randomness. Each one of those concepts is a gigantic mess. Each one of them is very poorly understood. Each one of them generates books every year trying to understand. Is it any surprise that we are tied up in a knot using these very poorly understood concepts? Should we not have some caution and say, if Zeno could tie us up with simple concepts for 2,300 years until a solution was found, it's very likely that there's a solution to this problem as well, because we're dealing with concepts we understand very poorly. So one way to live with it is to say the source of the problem is the fact that the concepts we're using are very poorly understood, and therefore we should expect paradoxes. Indeed, this is not the only paradox. There are other paradoxes as well, because they're very poorly understood concepts. That's one way to live with the problem. The other way to live with the problem is close to what he said, but not the same, and therefore it's very important to see that it's not quite what he said. What did we say yesterday? What is it that decides? Where do decisions take place? They take place in the soul. So when we try to understand free will, we are trying to understand something that the soul does. How well should we expect to understand the soul? According to our sources. What do our sources teach us about the soul and teach us about the strengths and weaknesses of our understanding, so that we could measure one against the other and see how we should expect our understanding of the soul to be? Well, our sources tell us that the soul is the chelek Elokam imam. It's a piece of God on high. The soul shares with God certain essential characteristics, or it has a similarity to some of the essential characteristics. If so, we really shouldn't expect to understand everything the soul does. And indeed, all of our sources agree that there are areas of the soul, elements of the soul, that really are beyond our ability to grasp, in a way similar to the fact that we can't grasp what God is. So when we are trying to come to grips with an aspect of the soul's activity, we are already prepared to find limitations in our understanding. So for us, it's not very shocking that the idea of free will is going to have a hole in it where our understanding stops. So two ways for living with the problem are, number one, to say that the intellectual problem is there because of the confusion in the concepts, and the other is to say that it's an element of the soul which we don't expect necessarily to understand. Which one is right? We don't know. The only way to discover which one is right is what? To solve the intellectual problem. If you solve the intellectual problem philosophically, then you know which one is right. It was a confusion in the concepts. If you don't solve it philosophically, it's always possible there is a philosophical solution that no one's thought of yet, or that it's a matter of how the soul functions. So it seems to me that we don't have to roll over and play dead because of this problem, because this problem involves concepts that are inherently poorly understood, and this can be just another symptom of their poverty of understanding. But it is a genuine, unsolved problem, and one that we just have to live with because no one knows how to handle it. Questions? Yeah.
One of the first one I was asked on the post, you know, thing is bothering me.
Yeah.
Why in the last 2,000 years did no one just say that this guy misconstrued the definition of movement instead of saying that he...
Okay.
Something, the definition of movement should be that in two instances, if something remains immobile, then it's not moving. That's what movement is.
Say that again. If something remains immobile...
For two instances, then it's not moving. If it's not going anywhere, uh-huh. It's not that in one instance it's not moving.
Okay, so...
It's that it's not in the same place in two separate instances.
I see. Okay. But now, suppose I ask you, how did it get from one place to the other?
Through a movement.
Well, but then, when was it moving?